Hey, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. So as you heard, I'm going to be covering the first three of the treatments that are going to be looked at today in the session. And these are treatments that I have been studying in my research activities. So, I feel I know them pretty well. And hopefully the information that I present will be of use to all of you. These are my disclosures based on a number of companies that have supported my research activities. So what I want to do in about a half hour or so is compare the efficacy or effectiveness, drug interactions and side effects of the three of the above mentioned complementary treatments. And hopefully we'll also get some time to discuss amongst ourselves and with you folks here about what else we can do with regards to the website and our outline to make it accessible and practical both to the consumer and to the practitioner. I'll also talk about some of the misunderstandings that are out there about complementary treatments, particularly for mental health conditions, and again how hopefully this project will be able to correct some of these misunderstandings so that both the consumer knows what they're taking and so and clinicians will also know how to advise their patients who may be interested in trying some of these treatments or as we were saying earlier, some of them may already be trying them without you even knowing about it. Just a few definitions. Remember, when we talk about complementary and alternative medicine, we're usually talking about treatments that don't usually conform to what the conventional medical beliefs are, and consequently, most of these treatments are generally not supported by the medical establishment. Certainly, as someone who does research on these treatments, I often come across a lot of skepticism from grant reviewers and so forth. So we do have to be very assertive about emphasizing the importance of this area. One of the arguments for studying these treatments is that it has been shown that more than 70% of the world's population uses some sort of chem therapy. And in the U.S., there are actually more visits to alternative practitioners per year than there are to primary care physicians. So this says that there's a very strong interest in these therapies, both in the U.S. and worldwide. And for that reason, I think the medical profession should study these therapies. Another thing to keep in mind is that certainly as a psychiatrist, I know that while we have probably about 24 antidepressants on the market for treating depression that are approved by the FDA, we know that these treatments have fairly limited efficacy. Recent data that have examined old studies and new studies and have carried out meta-analyses combining databases have shown that about 50% of people with depression will not respond adequately to antidepressants. So one in two people will not benefit. Another problem is that among those who do respond, many of them will eventually relapse. These antidepressants often have a way of pooping out, as we call it, or the technical term is tachyphylaxis, means that they stop working. Another problem is side effects. Antidepressants, even some of the newer ones that are better tolerated, still have side effects that are often bothersome. These may include weight gain, headaches, nausea, sexual dysfunction, and these can be deal breakers to many people who try them. So as a result of some of these limitations, many people do turn to CAM therapies, often as a last resort if they've tried a lot of conventional treatments without benefit or with many side effects. And we do know, certainly anecdotally, as well as from studies, that many people do benefit from these treatments. I was talking earlier about some misunderstandings about CAM. There are many caveats that have to be undertaken. Certainly, many sellers of these products will make claims that are exaggerated and don't have a great deal of science to support them. There are, in general, there are very few there are very few rigorous systematic studies examining these treatments. Comparisons with placebo, randomized trials, comparisons against established treatments. We don't have the body of work that we really need to make, conclusive recommendations. Another problem is that there's a very big misconception that just because these products are natural and can be bought in a health food store or over the counter, that they're automatically safe. And that isn't true. In fact, the more we learn about these natural products, the more we've learned about cases of toxic reactions occurring, often bothersome side effects, and interactions between these natural products and other drugs. So these natural products have to be handled with the same care that we handle any prescription medication. Another problem from the standpoint of the consumer is that for some of these products, there are many different brands out there, and many of them may vary with regard to how pure they are, what particular active products they may have. And this affects both the strength and the efficacy of these treatments. And then from a medico-economic standpoint, it's important to remember that most of these treatments are not usually covered by insurance carriers. This is because they don't have approval from the FDA. So this means that if individuals want to try these treatments, they have to pay for them out of pocket, and many of them can be quite pricey, and so they are not accessible to everybody. And finally, it is clear that many physicians and other medical practitioners are not really that well informed about these treatments. Certainly, when I was in medical school, I didn't really get any teaching about natural products or for that matter, about nutrition in general. That is changing. Today, more medical schools are including this in the curriculum as our residency programs. So that's certainly better, but there's still a lot of education that needs to take place among physicians in general. Now, let me, having said those introductory comments, let me talk a little bit about some of these specific products that we're interested in. The first one is St. John's wort, whose official name is Hypericum perforatum. It's a pretty yellow flower that blooms every spring around the day of St. John. That's one theory as to how it got its name. And this is the probably the best-selling natural product in the world. It is the one that has the most popularity worldwide. And at the same time, it is also one of the better studied, certainly among the ones that we are using in psychiatry. There's right now about 40 published clinical trials in the literature, including 26 comparisons with placebo and 14 comparing St. John's wort against established antidepressants. With this large number of studies, this has allowed for meta-analyses to be carried out where they combine different studies in order to get a sense of what is the overall impact of this treatment. Most of the research on St. John's wort has been performed in Europe, and some of the limitations of these studies are that they are often of short duration. A good antidepressant trial should run for about 8 weeks to make sure that the patients are improve if the treatment is effective. Some of these studies will often treat people for no more than a month, and so there are some people who may not get well initially who might have improved had they stayed on the treatment longer. Another problem is that some of these studies didn't use standardized diagnostic practices or instruments. In the US, we use a number of established instruments like the Hamilton Depression Scale, the Montgomery-Åsberg Scale, and so forth, that can tell us with a fair amount of accuracy just how much a patient is responding or not to a particular antidepressant. Taken together, the take-home message from these studies is that St. John's wort generally outperforms the placebo in most studies. In comparisons with low-dose tricyclic antidepressants, St. John's wort is about equivalent in efficacy, especially for mild to moderate depression. In Europe, they tend to use lower doses than tricyclics than we do in the US. That's why I specify that. More recently, there have been comparisons between St. John's wort and some of the newer antidepressants, such as the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, fluoxetine, sertraline, and others. By and large, again, we see that St. John's wort has been about equivalent to the SSRIs in efficacy and better than placebo, but the evidence has been a little bit more inconsistent with these recent studies. One reason for this is perhaps that the patients selected for these studies have more severe depression than those that were selected for the European studies, and that might explain why the results are less consistent. There's been a couple of investigations as to whether St. John's wort might work in certain subtypes of depression, for example, atypical depression, which is characterized by weight gain and increased appetite, lethargy, a need for increased sleep, and other symptoms, as well as for the depression associated with premenstrual syndrome. And there is evidence that St. John's wort is beneficial for these types of depression. Our group, in collaboration with Mark Rappaport's group at Cedars-Sinai, studied St. John's wort in a population with minor depression, which is a less severe form of depression. And we actually didn't find any significant advantage between St. John's wort and placebo. So we're still not clear as to what effect it may have on some of these less common forms of depression. How might St. John's wort work? There, as with all of these herbal preparations, there are many potentially active ingredients in a preparation. And it's with St. John's wort, hypericin and hyperforin are thought to be the key antidepressants. These are thought to interact with the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is involved in the production of cortisol. Cortisol, like all steroid hormones, has been associated with mood disturbances. So by regulating the activity of the HPA axis, it may dampen symptoms of depression. St. John's wort is generally considered safe. The usual side effects we see with it are dry mouth, dizziness, and constipation, which are common among antidepressants in general. There are some side effects that are more unique to St. John's wort, including phototoxicity or sensitivity to sunlight. People with bipolar disorder may cycle into mania if they take St. John's wort to treat their depression. And St. John's wort has also been shown to interact with many drugs, including birth control pills, for example, some of the immunosuppressive drugs that people who have transplants have taken, and some of the anti-HIV drugs. So for this reason, we need to be very careful if we're dealing with patients who are taking any of these drugs. With regard to depressed people, a lot of people who try to combine St. John's wort with SSRIs have often developed a condition called serotonin syndrome, which is actually quite a serious condition and potentially fatal if untreated. This involves a disruption of the person's metabolism, including fevers, shaking, sometimes seizures or coma. This is because St. John's wort has monoamine oxidase inhibiting activity, although no special diet is needed with St. John's wort, as the way you do with MAOI antidepressants. So basically, the take-home point: if someone's taking an SSRI, they should not be combining it with St. John's wort. One of the common questions I get asked: what about in pregnant women or in women who are breastfeeding? There have been a very few studies on this question. There has been evidence of some adverse effects in infants who are being breastfed, for example, colic, drowsiness, and lethargy. An animal study has shown that animals that are exposed to St. John's wort in utero may have lower birth weight than those not. There's one human study that examined women who had taken St. John's wort during pregnancy, and the study did not show any fetal malformations or any other problems. These data are very preliminary, and we need to proceed with caution with regard to advising pregnant or breastfeeding women. In this slide, I've listed the major interactions that I talked about earlier. St. John's wort induces the activity of a liver enzyme called cytochrome P3A4, which breaks down a variety of drugs, including the ones listed on the left column of the slide. So essentially, by stimulating the activity of this enzyme, St. John's wort accelerates the breakdown of some of these drugs, and consequently reduces their therapeutic activity. So as you can imagine, some of these interactions could lead to tragic consequences. There have been cases of transplants being rejected, HIV patients developing resistant strains of the virus as a result of the combination. So we do need to be very careful in terms of how we use St. John's wort. So to conclude, the results for St. John's wort, by and large, are encouraging. But they are inconsistent. My recommendation is that probably people with mild to moderate depression are the better candidates for St. John's Wort, and less so if they have more severe forms of depression. It's important not to combine it with SSRIs, as I mentioned. And the dosing of St. John's Wort is usually between 300 and 1800 milligrams a day, typically divided 2 to 3 times a day. But remember that these different preparations can vary in potency. So 300 milligrams of brand A may be delivering a different amount of active product than 300 milligrams of brand B. A lot of people will often ask me, what brands do you recommend? I usually don't like to push any particular brand for obvious reasons, but I have discussed that the brands that we study in our group are selected based on the fact that we know that the companies have very good manufacturing standards, and that at least what they say on the label is actually what's in the product. That said, we can't guarantee that a St. John's Wort preparation from a reputable seller is necessarily any better than one from some anonymous seller online or that you might find in a health food store. But it is a safer way to go about it. So that's what we recommend. Next, let me talk about the omega-3 fatty acids. The omega-3s are a large family of fatty acids, and there are two in particular that are of interest to psychiatrists, and those include DHA, or docosahexaenoic acid, you see in the picture above, and the other one is eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA. These are typically referred to as fish oils, because they are found primarily in fish, although the fish get most of their omega-3 from algae that are very rich in omega-3s. These are long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids that we do not manufacture ourselves, so we do need to get them in the diet. They are thought to have a variety of beneficial effects in humans. We know that they're able to interact with the brain cells and stabilize their membrane, and also actually enter the brain cells and interact with second messenger pathways. And the omega-3s also have anti-inflammatory effects. It's been proposed that depression can be caused by an increase in inflammatory activity, and potentially by dampening inflammatory activity, the omega-3s could have a beneficial effect on mood. Like St. John's Wort, the omega-3s are fairly well studied. There are more than 30 published randomized clinical trials in depressed populations, primarily using the omega-3 as an adjunct. In other words, it's given to people who are already taking a standard antidepressant and not responding satisfactorily. Most of these studies either use EPA alone with the standard antidepressant, or a combination of EPA plus DHA. Right now, there's only 2 studies in the literature that have examined DHA alone for depression, one of them by Lauren Merengel and one by our group. And basically, our study suggested that it is effective, and Dr. Merengel suggested that it's not. So, toss a coin. Another interesting finding about DHA in particular is that there was a recent study by Lewis and colleagues that suggested that DHA may have a protective effect against suicide. This was a study done in a military population. They found that that soldiers that had higher serum levels of DHA were less likely to commit suicide than those who had lower levels. So there is that certainly is relevant to depression, because suicidality is one of the common and most severe symptoms of depression. My colleague at MGH, Marlene Freeman, as well as Dr. Merengel, have studied the omega-3s in postpartum depression and also in pregnancy. Pregnancy has a major impact on the woman's omega-3 supplies, because the omega-3s are important for the baby's brain to develop fully. So typically, by the end of the pregnancy, most of the mother's omega-3 stores have been taken up by the child. So it's been suggested that depression during pregnancy and after birth could be related to a drop in omega-3. So there is some research in this area. Another area of interest for the omega-3s is in bipolar disorder, and there have been a couple of studies that have examined whether it's good in this population. The data suggests that the most of the benefits that the omega-3s have in bipolar individuals is primarily for alleviating the depressive phase, but it doesn't seem to have much impact for the manic phase. In fact, there is evidence that the omega-3s can precipitate mania just like any antidepressant can. There's another type of omega-3 alpha-linolenic acid or flaxseed oil, which is a vegetarian source that is generally not thought to have beneficial effects on mood. However, there's one study that came out recently in a pediatric population of children with bipolar illness, and this suggested some benefit. So there's reason to think that flaxseed oil may, after all, have some benefits in mood disorders or in certain populations. Finally, psychotic disorders, the omega-3s have been studied in patients with schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder. The results in these populations are not so convincing. Although the omega-3s have beneficial effects on lipid profiles and cardiovascular health, and obesity is common in schizophrenic patients because of side effects from antipsychotic drugs. And so some of these studies did suggest benefits as far as normalizing their lipid profiles. So schizophrenics may benefit from the omega-3s, at least in this regard. So our recommendations regarding the omega-3s for depression, it's been suggested that doses in the range of 1 to 4 grams per day are probably optimal. As I said, most of the studies either use pure EPA or combinations of EPA and DHA. A recent meta-analysis suggested that EPA is probably more effective than DHA. And the current consensus is that probably 1 to 2 grams a day of a combination of EPA and DHA with at least 60% EPA or 3 to 2 in favor of EPA might be the optimal approach to treating depression. With regards to bipolar disorder, the study suggests that higher doses may be necessary, often in the range of 6 to 10 grams a day, which is the equivalent of eating fish at practically every meal. As far as tolerability, the omega-3s are well tolerated. Stomach upset and fishy taste were the most common complaints, although most of today's preparations are more highly purified, and so these side effects are less common. Another concern is that in higher doses of 3 or more grams a day, there is a risk of bleeding if you're already taking a blood thinner, like Coumadin, for example. So we do advise caution in these populations. Again, in bipolar disorder, it has to be used with care, preferably in combination with a mood-stabilizing drug such as lithium in order to prevent cycling to mania. As far as pregnancy, it is presumed to be beneficial from the standpoint of benefits for the child, of course, in terms of the developing brain and also in allergy prevention. But we don't yet know what might be a safe upper limit for a pregnant woman to use. So while we certainly don't tell pregnant women you shouldn't take omega-3 supplements, we're not really in a position where we can make firm recommendations about what might be an optimal dose. So caution is always advised. And finally, let me talk a little bit about cranial electrical stimulation, which is a relatively new area of interest in our group. This is a device that's actually been used in Europe since the 1950s and in the US since the early 1960s. It's a device, as you see here, about the size of a transistor radio, that delivers a very small electrical pulse across the head or on the earlobes, as you see in the photograph on the right. And it's been used over the decades for a variety of ills. In fact, just about any condition, you can probably find some doctor who's recommending this device for it. It's interesting. This device is technically approved by the FDA, was grandfathered in primarily on the basis of safety rather than efficacy. So the FDA considers it a safe device, but they have not weighed in on whether they feel that it's effective for any indication in particular. How might this work? It's been suggested that this current that is delivered by the device travels through the skull into the brain and impacts on the limbic system, which is a part of the brain that's involved in regulating emotions. So it produces changes in the brain's neural firing patterns. That's one of the theories. As a result of this, it may rebalance some of the key neurotransmitters and neurohormones in the brain that are often thought to be disequilibrated in depressed states. Other theories that are a little more esoteric are that it might reset the master clock or the circadian system. We call this the synchronicity theory. And finally, the adaptogen theory, which you'll probably hear about in Richard's talk about rhodiola. An adaptogen assists the body in battling the effects of stress, perhaps by activating the cytokine system. This is probably similar to the way homeopathic remedies may work, essentially by stimulating the body to heal itself. As far as efficacy and safety data, there's actually quite a few studies, as you can see here, in a variety of conditions: depression, anxiety, insomnia, drug withdrawal, and cognitive dysfunctions. By and large, these studies are limited by small samples, although taken together, they often get patient samples in the high hundreds or even into the thousands. As you can see here, results, suggest the improvement in the range of 40 to 60% in this group as a whole. In depression in particular, the rate is probably about 47% based on these studies, which, as I pointed out earlier, is not so dissimilar from standard antidepressants. More recently, there was a study that just came out this year with 120 patients that suggested that CES was effective in combination with the antidepressant sertraline. There was also a pilot study that suggested benefit in 8 patients with a milder form of bipolar disorder called bipolar 2. This study has not yet been published, but it's been presented at an academic conference. So as far as what we know so far, CES seems to be very benign. It certainly doesn't cause any serious adverse effects. There have been a few cases of cycling into mania. So again, beware in bipolar disorder patients. While the studies as a whole are encouraging, they do have limitations. Most of them, as I said, have very small samples. They may be in the range of 20 to 30 patients. Also, many of these studies recruited people with various different diagnoses. So they may examine depression, but the people in the study may have major depression, generalized anxiety, other conditions. So it's different from most rigorous studies where they usually select people who have one clear diagnosis. The counter-argument as far as interpreting these data are that perhaps these studies may reflect real-world populations because certainly, the patients that I see in my practice may have any variety of psychiatric as well as medical conditions. Based on that, we might say this could reflect what we might expect in a clinical practice. Finally, I thought I'd say a few words about a study that's currently underway in our group in which we're studying the Fisher-Wallace device for treating major depression. So we're going to examine the efficacy and safety of this device in a subset of patients with DSM, diagnosed major depressive disorder. And this is a randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial. So we've recruited 30 adults between the ages of 18 and 65 with major depression, and the severity measured by the Hamilton Depression Scale. These are individuals who came in already taking a standard antidepressant and were not responding very well to it. And these patients were randomized to either active treatment with the CES device or a placebo sham, which means the CES device is actually turned off. The current on the CES device is actually quite weak, and consequently, even when it's on, patients don't necessarily feel the current, and so it's fairly easy to create a sham intervention. How does it work? So we place the electrodes on the scalp over the portion of the brain that is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and these patients, sorry, will receive 20 minutes a day of the treatment, or either the active or the sham, for 3 weeks. So usually we ask that they have 5 sessions at least per week. The device is programmed to run for 20 minutes and then turns itself off automatically. That way we know the patients are getting the exact amount that they need. The improvement will be based on the change in the Hamilton D score. What we define as clinical response means that the Hamilton D score should improve by at least 50% or more based on what it was at baseline. And this study is small, so it's not going to give us definitive answers, but it'll help us determine the effect size. And this will give us a sense of how big a sample would we need to do a more definitive study. Our working hypothesis is that obviously those who receive the CES intervention will have a significantly greater improvement in the Hamilton D score and a greater response rate compared to the placebo. We're estimating an effect size of about 0.5, which is considered an intermediate or moderate effect size. So it's not too strong, not too weak. If these results are encouraging, we will then follow up with larger, adequately powered comparisons between the CES and placebo, and hopefully also comparisons between CES and FDA-approved antidepressants, as well as other somatic therapies. So, in conclusion, who should use CAM? I tend to steer people who are mildly ill and have a strong interest in complementary medicine. These people don't have much to lose by trying a natural or alternative product. If it doesn't work, they can always go to a standard antidepressant. Then at the other end of the spectrum, there are those who've already tried just about everything that's on the market and didn't get benefit or simply had a lot of side effects. But I do caution that these people are often the most difficult to treat. And as I said, most of these complementary interventions are best suited for people with milder forms of illness. Finally, be careful with patients who are on multiple medications because of some of these concerns about interactions. In closing, I hope you found this information interesting. These are the types of things that will be discussed in the web page. And so perhaps later on during the question answers, we can talk a little bit about how the web page can help the consumer as well as the clinician. So thank you very much.